So this afternoon we've got a new to move on to, our new topic and last topic, which we'll spend 2 weeks covering. Peer-to-peer systems. Before we get started on it, again, something about the assignment, just to clarify why I introduced this concept of bandwidth delay. The bandwidth delay product is the product or the multiplication of the bandwidth of the network and the delay. We talk about when we do our test data rate and the delay being the round trip time. Work, it's in fact data rate. We can set that UTC or the network has some delay. Yep. The multiplication of those two is what's called the bandwidth delay product. That's an important bandwidth and delay together are two important metrics for operation of TCP. And that, the concept at least, we can revert back to what we know about stop and wait and sliding window protocols, because TCP is a sliding window protocol where we can send multiple frames at once, then having to wait for an ACK to come back. This is an illustration of stop and wait, where we send one frame, one packet, we stop and wait for an ACK to come back. Then we'd send another packet, stop and wait. The problem with stop and wait is it's very inefficient because we spend a lot of time waiting. This time, the time to transmit a packet is calculated as the size of that packet divided by the data rate. So if in all cases we have a fixed size packet, and the data rate varies, then an important impact or important factor that impacts upon stop and wait's performance is the data rate. Increase the data rate, and this packet transmission time gets larger. Decrease, and it gets smaller. We transmit a data frame, it propagates to the other side. We transmit an ACK back, and that propagates to the other side. Assuming the ACK is small, then to propagate to the other side and come back is approximately our round trip time, the time to get there and back. So in stop and wait, the time to transmit a frame is dependent upon the data rate of our network or of our link, and of course the size of that frame, but let's say every frame or packet is the same size. And the time to get there and come back is our round trip time. Of course, TCP is not stop and wait. TCP is sliding window, which allows us to send multiple packets before potentially you have to wait. But the same concept or issues will impact upon the performance. In this case, we transmit three packets, and then because of the round trip time, we don't receive the first ACK until slightly after transmitting the third packet. That is, transmit packet 1, packet 2, packet 3, then wait for this time period here before the first ACK comes back. When we receive an ACK, we can transmit another packet. Transmit another packet, packet 4. When we receive an ACK, transmit another packet, and so on. In this case, this duration, the time to transmit one packet, and whether or not the first ACK comes back before we've transmitted the third packet, and the time that we have to wait here depends upon round trip time. The larger the round trip time, the larger this time we'd have to wait, because we send a packet, if the round trip time was to get here and then come back, we'd have to wait a long time. Here's a case where we have a shorter round trip time, a very short round trip time. Transmit a packet. While we're transmitting the second packet, the first ACK comes back, allowing us to transmit the fourth packet. So we transmit 1, 2, 3. Keep transmitting. In this case, the round trip time is small enough such that we can keep transmitting packets in our sliding window mechanism. This is, of course, better throughput. We're always transmitting. This is lower throughput. We transmit, then wait. Transmit, wait. So the throughput of this protocol is going to depend upon the data rate. How long is this period? And what is the round trip time? How long to get ACK back? And that's why the TCP depends upon the bandwidth delay product. It depends upon our data rate and our round trip time. Increasing the data rate is going to decrease this time, that is less time to transmit a packet. If the data rate is higher, the time to transmit a packet is lower, and we'd spend more time waiting, less time transmitting. Increasing the data rate will decrease the throughput. Similar, increasing the round trip time. Round trip time was to here, we'd spend much more time waiting. Increasing either of these two decreases our throughput. Increasing the round trip time in this case is going to decrease our throughput. So in this case, the round trip time is small. That is, send a packet, round trip time is small, we get an ACK back. We're allowed to transmit another packet. So in this specific example, we're always allowed to transmit packets. This one, the round trip time is large. See, here's small, here it's large. Because it's large, we transmit three, let's say we have a window of three, and then we have to wait some time because we're still waiting for the first round trip time to complete. And then we can transmit another packet. So an increased round trip time decreases our throughput because we spend more time waiting. An increased data rate relative to the round trip time decreases the transmission time here, that is, this box will get smaller, and again we'd spend more time waiting because we'd transmit 1, 2, 3 and then have to wait a long time. Increased data rate, lower throughput. Increased round trip time, lower throughput. Increased round trip time means I'm waiting for the ACK to come back. Increased data rate means a smaller time transmitting. And we'd like to, high throughput is when we transmit more of the time. Increasing either of those two reduces our throughput. And that's bandwidth delay product, just the multiplication of those two, impacts upon TCP throughput. The other thing that impacts upon TCP throughput is what the server has available in its buffer. So this is just about the mechanism of the sliding window. But the server, it's more complex than this, because the server tells us how much you're allowed to send. That depends upon the buffer size at the server. And that's why when we change this minus W option in IPERF, we change the buffer size at the server And that will also impact upon TCP throughput. That's why I'd like you to run experiments where you change the buffer size, but also relative or think about what the bandwidth delay product is. That is, what is the value of these two? Sometimes this will limit the throughput of TCP and change the buffer size. The buffer size will limit the throughput of TCP. That's why you need to work out which one, when does each come into play. That's why considering the bandwidth delay product is important with TCP. Any questions on that and the assignment before we move on to peer-to-peer systems? It may seem complex, but in fact, remember, stop and wait's the simplest protocol we have, almost. It's very easy. It's an extension where we can not send one and then have to wait, but can send multiple and have to wait. The longer we wait, the lower the throughput. The longer the round trip time, the lower the throughput. The higher the data rate, the lower the throughput. So for your assignment, what you're doing, varying the buffer size of the server as well as the data or the round trip time. I think just varying one of them should be sufficient because they both impact upon the bandwidth delay product. Let's talk about peer-to-peer systems for 30 minutes, and then we'll come back to some tasks for you towards the end of the lecture. So peer-to-peer systems, we've got, in fact, two sets of lecture notes. One's on peer-to-peer, one's on BitTorrent, but they all both fall under peer-to-peer systems. Any last questions on the assignment? Any problems? Why not? What's hard? Nothing's hard. You don't know what's hard. Let's talk about peer-to-peer systems. What do we know about a peer-to-peer system? Try to describe and classify them, and then we'll start with some example concepts, example peer-to-peer systems. We're going to focus on file sharing as an example of a peer-to-peer system, but there are others. There are many other applications which use the concepts of peer-to-peer. So we'll explain what we mean by the concept of peer-to-peer first. Some of this introductory stuff will go really quickly. Of course, in the internet, we have large-scale applications where we have many users involved. And the scale of such applications means that we need adequate resources to support applications. Most applications are based on a centralized server. All the users access that server to use the application. Whether the application is web browsing, search, or some special purpose application, often they involve using a server and clients accessing that server. That involves a lot of effort if you want to support a lot of users because that server needs to have enough resources so that many users can access that server at the same time. That can be a problem when you start to talk about thousands, tens of thousands. thousands, millions of users accessing the one server. So this is a fact from, well, quite old now. This is almost 10 years ago. That, and that's a long time ago in terms of internet time, and Google was using something like 15,000 computers to support their search engine. And now many data centers to support their search service. So in this client-server architecture, you need a lot of resources for the server. So what about an alternative? Rather than relying on this centralized approach, can we have a distributed approach? And that's what peer-to-peer systems provide for. Rather than having a centralized server, we decentralize the processing and the storage. Peer-to-peer systems perhaps become popular from consumers' point of view from file sharing applications. That is, individual users could share files between each other rather than having to share files from a central server, things like Napster, but used in many other applications as well. The idea is to not rely on large, complex, centralized servers. So servers in a client-server architecture, we need a server which can process requests from many clients. It needs a lot of memory, it needs a lot of storage space and a lot of processing capability and a lot of bandwidth to access that. We'd like to avoid that. So that our system or our overall application can be scalable. Scalable means it works well as we increase the number of users. So it can scale from thousands of users to millions of users. Load sharing, a centralized system in the server, all of the load is on the server. Load sharing, we distribute the load amongst the different. And fault tolerance. If a single server fails, our system will fail, client server system. In a peer-to-peer system, we'd like to avoid that such that if some entities fail, the system still works. So the difference between client-server architecture and a peer-to-peer architecture is, or the advantages and disadvantages are summarized here. Client-server system is a centralized system. We have a server and many clients access that. And that's why we'd say it's asymmetric. We have one server, many clients accessing that one server. That is, the server has a special role. Many clients access that individual server. Peer-to-peer system, there's usually a symmetry of the exchange of data and the connections between the different users, and those users are decentralized. There's no single server involved. So in a client-server system, a client requests data or functionality from a server. Of course, in real applications, internet applications, to cope with large number of requests, we normally replicate the servers. Google web server is not just a single computer. It's many computers distributed around the world. So even with client server systems, we replicate the servers so that all requests do not go to a single server. We spread the requests around multiple servers. But conceptually, we can think of that as one server. And in fact, replicating servers is complex as well because you need to keep them up to date. With peer system, we do not distinguish between clients and servers. We say is a peer or is a peer to each other. Client server, we have entities are clients and other entities are servers. In a peer-to-peer system, everyone is... Every entity is the same. A peer may act as a client or a server. A peer may request information or functionality from another entity, and it also may, like a client does, and it also may provide responses or functionality like a server does. So in a peer-to-peer system, often we can think of a peer as being both a client and a server. Individual peers with each other. They work with each other to achieve some service. So the advantages and disadvantages, well, they're like the advantages and disadvantages of any centralized system versus a decentralized system. Client-server, we have a single point of failure. If the server fails, the entire system or service is unavailable. And we have performance bottlenecks at the server. The server needs to be fast in terms of processing and in terms of bandwidth, because there are many requests coming in. If it starts to become slow, then it will slow down the entire service. The advantages of client-server system is that it's easy to control access to resources and functionality. Because everyone who wants to access a resource or functionality goes to the server can control who accesses this information or these resources. There's a single point where we can control things and provide security. And the algorithms needed for communicating and sharing information are generally simple and can be implemented in an efficient manner, such as for searching for information. The advantages and disadvantages of peer-to-peer systems are really the opposite of what we've got here. We no longer depend on a single central server. It's easy to add new users, because a new user provides new capacity to the system. In a client-server system, we have a server. Let's say we have 1,000 users of that 1,000 clients. If we want to add another 1,000 clients, that requires a significant upgrade of our server, because it's going to introduce extra load. That's a problem. In a peer-to-peer system, if we have 1,000 peers, those peers, if we add another 1,000, that can be of benefit to the system. Having 2,000 peers, we may have more resources to share amongst each other. So adding new users is not so bad in the system. The system scales well. As the number of users increases, the system still works well. The problem is that the algorithms we need to communicate and to search for information have become complex. It's hard to control access to resources. In a client-server system, everything goes through the one server. The server can control who accesses those resources. And a peer-to-peer system, each of the peers can act as servers, and therefore it's harder to control who can access a particular resource. So there are trade-offs. Some practical benefits of peer-to-peer systems: because peers store information, and we'll see they can store resources, whereas in a client-server system, the server stores the information. Increasing the number of peers effectively increases our storage space across the entire system. The more users, the more information we can store with a peer-to-peer system. So that's a benefit, or can be a benefit. And also, the more users, the more choices we have to access information and resources from, and the better we can distribute or share the load across the system, making it easier for users to download or to exchange information. So we'll see some examples of this when we look at the specific peer-to-peer systems. And in some cases, the more users, the more knowledge we have in the system. And we can do things like classify resources, classify information in an easier manner. When you hear about peer-to-peer systems, it's often referred to many different things. It means, may refer to an application, a peer-to-peer application. It may refer to a protocol, some formats of messages we send between nodes using peer-to-peer applications. It may refer to an algorithm, a peer-to-peer algorithm. So, some examples. The internet, in particular IP, is a peer-to-peer system. In that even though the internet applications are client-based, the internet, each computer that uses IP is treated the same. It's just another host using on the internet. Whether it's a web server or my laptop, from IP's perspective, they're all the same. So my point is that peer-to-peer, when you hear about peer-to-peer systems, you have to be careful whether people are talking about an application, a protocol that the application uses, or a set of algorithms. As we go through the examples, I'll try and give, or I'll classify them as whether it's an application, a protocol, or an algorithm. Another thing that we need to be careful is that you know how to program client-server applications now. You can write socket-based code for a client and a server, and they can communicate. That's client-server-based communication. Peer-to-peer applications still use that socket-based code, that client-server-based code. So if you want to write your own file-sharing application, peer-to-peer file-sharing application, you would still use that same type of code, where you set up a server or you set up a process to listen and set up another process to send a request to another server. That's because we can often think of peer-to-peer nodes as both a client and a server. They act as both. Another way that people classify peer-to-peer systems based on whether it's an application, some platform that supports the development of peer-to-peer applications, or algorithms that support the development of platforms. Again, as we go through examples, I'll try and let you know which is which. Let's look at a problem that arises in peer-to-peer systems. So, for now, we know that peer-to-peer systems, we have a set of nodes or entities, whether they are computers or applications running on computers, and they are all treated equally. There's no special server. Everyone's a peer to each other. And we'd like to use these peers to form some network such that we can communicate with each other and exchange information or perform some operations, to implement some application. One of the problems that arises in peer-to-peer systems is how to find information, how to find resources. So resource location is an issue, and we'll go through several solutions for resource location. Now, to see what issue, let's see how do we locate resources in a client-server system. I'll say a resource is a file that we want to access, but it doesn't have to be a file. The resource could be some computational ability or some portion of a file. But it's often easiest to think in terms of accessing a file that we want to find. So in a client-server system, we have a server and clients that will access that server to perform some application. The normal approach to locate resources in a client-server system is to contact the server. That is, the server knows about the location of the network or in the system. As an example we'll use throughout this topic is we want to share files amongst users. But the clients want to access a set of files, and every client should be able to access those files. One approach in a client server system is that all the files are stored on the server. So all the files that to be shared amongst all the clients are stored on the server. If client 1 is looking for a file, they want to access that, they can simply send a request for the file. And if the server has it, it can send back directly that file with that resource. So that's very easy to locate resources in this space. That is, the server knows about all the resources. For a client to access the resource, they simply send a message to the server saying, do you have this resource? And yes, if it does, it sends back the resource. If not, it sends back, no, we don't. That's a simple example of locating resources in a client service. We could generalize that a little bit more by... Well, no, we'll do that in one of the last slides. Let's introduce some terminology first. So, what we'll do is that we'll refer to where resource. Some resource R, but it could be a portion of a file. The resource could be function that can be applied, some computational ability. We want to access some resource that allows us to perform some operation, some piece of memory. So we'd like to locate a resource. We will say that each resource can be identified by some key. The key in our case could be the file name. The resource is the actual file itself. The file name is the key, the thing that uniquely identifies that resource. In large systems, file names are not good identifiers because you may have a file called steve.txt and someone else may have the same file name but being a different resource. So in large systems, because there's nothing to stop having two different files but having the same name spread across computers. Generally, file names are not good identifiers. We need some unique identifier to identify a resource. We'll give an example of what we could use in case of file shortly. But for now, let's assume we can use file names as keys, something that identifies our resource. Now, we have a peer-to-peer system. Coming back to this one first, let's say these are computers in the internet. Here's a server. For the clients to access a resource, they need to know the address of the server. That was something that I didn't mention. We need to know some address to contact. Server, an IP address, for example. IP address and port number. And we get that on the main name. So if I know this server's IP address, I can send a request to it saying, do you have file 2? And if it does, it can send back a response. That's easy in a client server system. Now, in a peer-to-peer system, there's no special server. The files share are distributed amongst all the peers. So file 1 is here, file 2 is here, file 3. That is, these files, these resources, are located at some of the peers. Peer 3, for example, wants to find a resource. What does it do? Well, there's no central sender request. We've just got peers. So if we want to find files, what can peer 3 do? What's it going to do? These are computers on the internet. Anywhere in the internet, what can peer 3 do to find file 2? What is the file name? It's ITS413 exam answers.pdf. You know the file name, you know what you're looking for. What are you going to do to find it? How? These are the only computers in our system. Again, so send a request to everyone. That's the approach. Everyone in the network, in the system, saying, do you have file 2? Some request for file 2. Send it to everyone. And a way to send to everyone, well, there are different ways. You need to know about some nodes to send. All right. In this case, there are 8 nodes. What happens when there are 1,000 nodes in the system? You may not know the address of everyone. In this case, to send to the server, I needed to know its address. Okay, that's easy. It's not hard to inform all the clients of one server's address. Now, how does P3 know about the address of all the other nodes in the system? So to send their address. So to simplify that, we could say, let's find out the address of some peers. Not everyone. Let's somehow, I'll explain somehow in a moment, but let's somehow find out the address of P4, P5, and P2. So I find out the address of these 3 peers. I send a request to them saying, do you have file 2? Do you file 2, do you have file 2? And this is where the concept of broadcast comes in, or flooding. If they don't have the answer, they could send it to other peers that they know. Peer 4 doesn't have file 2, but it knows about peer 6 and peer 5, so it sends that request. Peer 2 doesn't have file 2, but it knows about peer 1. Sends the request to peer 1, and so on. So to send to everyone in the system, we use flooding. Send to your neighbour peers, and your neighbour peers send the request on to their neighbours, who send it on to their neighbours, and if you keep doing that, eventually everyone in the network will receive the request, including saying, I have file. So that's how you can send a request to everyone. We will see shortly that that's one solution for locating resources in peer-to-peer systems. I skipped over, how does peer 3 know about 4, 5, and 2? How do we know the addresses of these 3? Well, when we start our system, when a peer wants to join the system, there needs to be some special procedure to find out about some other peers already. We'll see later that sometimes there'll be a special server that keeps track of the addresses of some peers. Maybe it knows about peer 2 and peer 4. So when a new peer joins the system, peer 9, it contacts the server and says, tell me some of the peers. It says, okay, peer 2 is your neighbour. So now peer 9 knows about peer 2. It can send a request, and peer 9 could send a request to peer 2 saying, who are your neighbours? And peer 2 could send back, I know peer 3 and peer 1. So now peer 9 knows about peer 2. So we need some way to get started when we look at a specific. Illustrates that searching for information, locating resources, is complex. It's not as simple as knowing the address of a server, sending a request, getting a response. We know that flooding like this is very inefficient. You have 1 million nodes in here, and you send a message that goes to 1 million. million different computers in the internet, and it will not work. You'll never get a response. There'll be too many messages sent through the network. So we'll see, we need better approaches. So now let's generalize, or let's give some notation to this problem that we need to solve. And specific solutions for this problem. The problem is that we have a group of peers. In our group had 8 peers, P1 to P8. We have some peers. Each peer has an address. Alright, as just a number. But in the internet, that address would normally be an IP address and maybe a port number. And so each peer has an address and stores some resources. And let's denote that as uppercase R of P, resources on PP. So the resources on PP set were file. Each resource is identified by a key. Now, example, the file was identified by its file name. But in general, we have some key to identify the resource. Because it may not be a file. It could be a portion of a file. Let's say the file is large. It could be just some part of that file. So we don't identify by the file name. We need some other identifier. And normally it needs to be unique. But some key that identifies resource. So, the problem is, if a node has the key that they're looking for some resources, so they're looking for a resource and they know the key for that resource, then find the peer that stores that resource. That was our problem. Peer 3 was looking for the file named file 2. To find it, it needs to know the address of the peer.
For this to work, in fact, in both of these cases, to
search for information, we have an index. We need an index that maps keys to peers. We can say this is an index. The file name maps to a particular node that stores that file. File 1 is stored at server. File 2 at server. File 3 at server. In a very simple case, all files are stored on the server. In this case, the index, file 2 is on P6. File 3 is on P7. File 1 on P1. To generalize, instead of having to store a file, if P1 has that file, we don't necessarily have to find P1. What we'd like to do is find the index that tells us where file 1 is. So, in fact, the index information which maps peers can be distributed. So what we could also have on peer 5, we could have file 2 is on peer 6. Be some index information stored on peer 5. When P3 sends a request for file 2, peer 5 receives that, looks in the index, and realizes, okay, file 2 is stored at peer 6. Send back a response to peer 3 saying file 2 is at peer 6. And then peer 3 can access that resource. So we don't necessarily have to have the index stored on each peer. We can have the index information stored on other peers. That is, information about the resources and where they are located can be displayed. See that can help locating resources. Because if we store the index information on all peers, let's see if we can illustrate that. The make it clear. Let's get rid of our lines. Go back to our initial setup. We have three files stored on these three nodes. Let's create the index information for the entire system. We could index for this system here is file 2 is at peer 6, file 1 at peer 1, and file 3 at peer 7. That's our index information for the system. We need to distribute that amongst the peers. We currently have the information stored on the peers that have the files, but we can put it in other places. The best case for search would be to put this index information on all peers. If every peer knew this information, when we send a request, then we can immediately get a response. If peer 4 knew this, if peer 3 sends a request for file 2, peer 4 can immediately respond saying, file 2 is at peer 6. So for search, the best case is to put the index information on all peers. But how do we do that? That's the complex thing. How does peer 4 know that file 2 is on peer 6, file 1 on peer 1, file 3 on peer 7? That's complex. So information amongst peers to make search easy, but also to make it easy for distributing that index information. We see that in peer systems, we will not have a single peer storing the entire index, we will have a portion of the index system distributed. And like we just went through the example, to find information, we send requests to neighbor nodes. Let's go through one example and then we'll come back to the general. The one example is based on, or is used in, the original popular file sharing application. Napster was both an application and also a protocol for sharing music files. And so that was considered a peer-to-peer application. Let's look at how it was. We have a slide on it somewhere. Just to illustrate one example. So Napster itself was an application, a piece of software you could install, but also a protocol for communicating between the Napster applications. It was a directory-based architecture, so we'll explain what that is through an example of what it looked like. There were peers. These were the end users, the peers, and they had the resources, the files that they want to share. So peer one would have some files. Other peers would have files. Let's have one more, peer 4. So peers would have files or resources that they want to share. There was also a central server, the Napster server. this was a case which is a very which combined the client-server architecture with a peer-to-peer architecture for accessing files. And what it was that the index information that maps resources or keys for resources to peers was in fact stored all on one node. The Napster server stored information that says file 1 is at peer 1, file 3 is at peer 1, file 1, peer 3, file 7 at peer 3, file 2 at peer 4, and all the other information if we have other peers. That is, this stores the index that maps keys to peers. Where a key identifies a resource. In our case, the key is the file name. The file is the actual resource. So here we had an index stored all on one server. And to search to locate resources was easy. Peer 2 wants to locate a resource. They send a request for file 2, that resource that they're looking for, or the key that identifies that resource. They send it to the central Napster server. This looks up in the index, file 2, peer 4 sends back a response. Now, that's client-server-based location of services. The peer-to-peer part in Napster is the actual resource sharing. Now, when peer 2 wants to access this file, it sends a request direct to peer 4 and downloads the file. So this is a combination of client-server and peer-to-peer. For the search, it's really client-server-based. Everything goes to the one server. The server maintains an index. The server responds with the identifier of the peer that has the resource. For the accessing the resources, it's peer-to-peer based. We go direct to a peer to download from. So in fact, it wasn't a true peer-to-peer system because it's very dependent on this central server. And that was the failure, or that led to the failure of Napster. The fact that it stored all this information caused legal problems and also performance problems. So that's an example for the storing the index, except once we know who has the resource, we use the approach to access that resource. Whereas in a normal web system, the resource is stored on the server. So to search for file 2, we send a request to the server. The server sends back the actual file. The actual data transfer is from client to server in a client-server system. The search was client to server. The data transfer was peer-to-peer. That's the difference there. Again, we have problems. If this server fails, we cannot search, and if we cannot search, we have problems because we don't know which peers have the files. So we'll see that their approach is to improve upon that, that this index across peers rather than all on one central server. We'll see how search is used in different peer-to-peer systems. And most do not use this anymore. They use a more distributed approach. We'll see that when we come to BitTorrent. That is, how do peers communicate with each other and how they will locate each other in the BitTorrent part of the lecture. This has a major problem because we have some central organization controlling the index. We have a central point of failure. It can provide security mechanisms because central server can control who accesses these resources. So it's very close to a client server system. Except we don't have the bottleneck at the server from the data transfer. The server is not involved in the data transfer. That's direct. The server just tells us who do you download the data from. I want to do something else. I want to have a quiz. So let's stop there and have our quiz. We'll go through. So next week what we'll do is go back to the concepts, and then we'll go through alternatives or improvements on that, which get closer to this approach. Everything is fully distributed. The index is distributed among the central server. See the issues that arise there. But let's do that next week so we have some time for a quiz. Take a piece of paper, take a quiz. Grab a piece of paper that's being passed around. Blank piece of paper to write your answer. You don't have to do the CSS 322 security. You write your answer on the back. It's just blank piece of paper. Okay. So I'll just, like we did in our first quiz a while ago, we'll show some questions up here. They're not true or false, or most of them are not. You just write your answer, and then we'll mark that afterwards. So clearly write your answer. Some will go through quickly. Some will give you a little bit more time. First one. Which delivery mechanism, that is a thing that ends in cast, something cast, is a one-to-one mapping from address to host? Try to do it yourself. No need to look at or ask your friends. What delivery mechanism? Something asked. You need to remember what they are. Choose the right one. Or the right ones, perhaps. Maybe there's more than one. Okay. This one, I'll actually draw the network a little bit clearer. We have a source, two routers, and three LANs. That is, this is one LAN, the second LAN, and the third LAN by router. There are three destination hosts on LAN 3. So there are three users attached to here. Two destinations attached to LAN 2. There's no multicast available at layer 2 level. What is the minimum number of packets transmitted? Layer 3 IP multicast. Sorry, layer 3 multicast. I'll draw the network a bit clearer. That's what I mean by the diagram. Three LANs, two routers, a source, and five destinations. Five that need to receive the data from the source. Three of them are on this LAN, two on this LAN. Minimum number of packets to be transmitted if using multicast. So by transmitted, if a source sends a packet to router 1, that's 1. If router 1 sends to router 2, that's a second packet. How many in total? Using IP multicast. What is the minimum number of packets transmitted if using IP multicast or layer 3 multicast? All right, a hint, multicast broadcast not available in layer 2, which means that, let's say we cannot broadcast from a source to everyone on this LAN. We'd have to use unicast. That's all I mean by that one. What if we use multiple unicast? Next question. Same network, same conditions, using multiple unicast. What's the answer? So that's question 3. Question two using IP multicast. Question 3 using one minute on that one. We don't have much time to get through these. All right, let's move on. Simple one. True or false? TCP is often used for multicast applications. True or false? Think about why as well. Because if you choose one of them, make sure you know why you chose that, not random. True or false? DiffServe provides guaranteed quality of service by reserving resources across a path. You need to know what DiffServe is. It's a quality of service mechanism, and I tell you it stands for differentiated services. Guaranteed quality of service, that is, you can provide guarantees of things like packet delay, data rate or throughput by reserving resources across the path. So you reserve some resource in a router or across a link. This one we'll come back to. It takes a lot of time. In streaming applications, buffering can be used to reduce the impact of something at the expense something else. What are those two? Two words. what does buffering improve for us? It reduces something, but the negative thing is it increases the startup something. Think of the performance metrics that are of interest. There are only 4 or 5 performance metrics that we've really talked about. Okay, you can do this. This is a mix and match question. Match these to these. That is, these 4 characteristics. Number one is the less than 100 milliseconds, throughput greater than 10 kilobits per second. Which application does that correspond with? You can only select from these 4. So if I want, say, a large file download, which of these best describe what I need in terms of performance? So what you want to be writing down is a letter and the corresponding number. So just organizing those 4. Large file download, web video streaming, maybe YouTube, voice over IP call, something like Skype, and IPTV, watching your favorite program delivered across an IP network. So think of which ones require the lowest delay, and which ones require the highest throughput, or what combination is the best. So these are the think of these as the desired performance characteristics. For example, you may read it, if A would read it as a large file download, should have a delay of less than 100 milliseconds and a throughput greater than 10 kilobits per second. Is that the best match? Or maybe another one is better? Quick look. We'll come back if we have time. A set of protocols. Here are their names. Choose. The answer is from these. Which protocol is used for setting up a voice call? We'll go through the quick ones and come back and give you some time on the other ones. Choose one of them. Which protocol is used for setting up a voice call in the internet? Is it IGMP, ICMP, RTSP, RTCP, SIP, SS7, or voice over IP? In Next, no, I don't know if the numbers are correct. Next one, which protocol is used for streaming video packets in IPTV? Same set of protocols to select from. I'll go back. Same set of protocols. First one, set up a voice call. Which one? Second one, stream video packets in IPTV. Which protocol are you going to choose? Third one, select a channel in IPTV. So three questions, all using the same set of protocols. Set up a voice call, send video packets, select a channel. Set up a voice call, stream video packets, select a channel. Last one. Then we'll go back. Four choices. Which one do you want? FTTN, FTTC, FTTH, ADSL 2+. Which one do you want? There's one more question which we haven't done yet, so we'll go back. But there's one good answer. You're not a good engineer. All right, let's go back. Everyone finish this one? 1 minute, and then we've got one more. Large file download, web video streaming, voice call over IP, IPTV. I don't think these question numbers are correct. And paste some fire. There's one more question. Make sure you have your answer, your name on your piece of paper. I'm going to collect them in a moment. Okay. Done this one. Okay. Finish. Okay. Put your names on there. Question, which is a bonus. You don't have to write it down, but if you tell me the answer, bonus. Name on there. I know. Question. That's a hard one. Oh, well, not hard. Time consuming. Or you can think about it in your head, write it on another piece of paper. You should be able to answer. Got a particular sample size of a voice codec, 10 bytes. Sample interval, 5 milliseconds. The total size of the headers, 40 bytes. How big is the payload? Remember, RTP packet has payload, voice data, plus headers. Payload is some size. The headers, 40 bytes. As a result, the data rate that we need to send, or the bandwidth, each call consumes 3.3 kilobytes per second. How big would the payload be? And once you answer that, you can, if you want a piece of paper, just do it on your own notes if you don't have a piece of paper. When you have an answer, you can leave. You can stay. Leave whenever you like. Sample size, 10 bytes. Sample interval, 5 milliseconds. All right, hint. That means 200 samples per second. Total size of headers, 40 bytes. Total size of payload, you need to calculate. Per call, 3.3 kilobytes per second. So we're sending RTP packets that are of some size. It consumes 3.3 kilobytes per second. How big are they? So that is the end of our time. So try and answer it. If you cannot answer it now, then tell me the answer at some other time. From memory, the answer is 60. Make sure, see if you can calculate. 60 bytes. See, so you need to be able to find that answer. 60 bytes.